You're listening to a classic business podcast as heard on Classic 1027. 1027.
Are we in a stock market bubble at the moment? And if we are, what should investors do about it? Now, historically, it's always been hard to know how far a bull market can go. And value has proven to be a very weak read on which to lean, because value can go up and up. I mean, the nightmare for any value manager was certainly Japan in 1989, when the price-earnings ratio went to 65 times. It had never previously been over 25 until that particular cycle. But bond market moves this week have made investors nervous that the frothy parts of the market could be the first to go in a panicked sell-off. The forecast for average inflation over the next decade derived from bond prices has risen to nearly 2.2%, the highest level since 2014 in the US, partly reflecting soaring commodity prices. These nerves have turned the global government bond market into the weakest start of the year since 2015, as inflation erodes the value of interest payments on bonds and reduces the value of debt. Now, the scale of the sell-off prompted Australia's central bank to launch a surprise bond buying operation to try and staunch the bleeding this morning, helping yields there come off early peaks. And if rates rise sooner than expected, Tito's budget forecast might have to be tossed out of the window. Well, to review the week that was and this week's budget, I'm joined now by Warwick Lucas, Chief Investment Officer at Galileo Asset Managers, and Raymond Parsons, Professor in the School of Business and Governance at Northwest University. Warwick, let's start with markets this week. And last week we said we had the sense that the reflation trade is now omnipotent. This week the bond route has really gathered momentum. If you just look at what happened in Australia this morning, and let me play devil's advocate for a while. The people who remain bullish make the following argument, which I'm sure you've heard a million times, which is bond yields are incredibly low, and the difference between government bond yields and the return on stocks is actually historically normal. The Fed has the power to keep those bond yields low, and therefore that relationship will hold and stock valuations will stay high. Do you agree with that?
Well, good afternoon, Michael. That argument is only going to hold for as long as the bond market will play its part, which is in terms of setting the risk-free rate at a low level. And quite clearly, if bond rates start going higher, then the return demanded from equities will start going up, and or the so-called risk premium available from equities at their current levels starts diminishing, which then starts becoming a fairly negative headwind for equities. You know, especially if inflation starts coming in and looks like it's going to persistently put pressure on the bond market and ultimately on central banks. It's far from a guaranteed kind of argument. It's very much an if-then type of argument. And those kind of if-then constructions can turn out to be rather flimsy. Now, so far, we've seen some negative equity moves this week. U.S. markets particularly down in the areas where you have very long out time horizons, i.e. your tech stocks and so on, which were up very much on long out earnings horizons. I mean, a heck of a lot of the mid and upper mid tier of tech stocks really have no earnings to talk of. It's based on, well, what will happen in future, and all sorts of sunny sky projections. But when the tacky hits the road, well, you know, the question is if your funding costs are going to go up, well, so your earnings prospects are going to start diminishing. And I think that's really what we've seen happening on U.S. markets. I mean, the biggest knocks by far are happening amongst NASDAQ grouping of stocks, and as opposed to the broad Dow Jones.
And that is the big concern, I guess, for the TINA trade, as it's been called. There is no alternative. It's been all about techs, and we are starting to see that unwind a little bit. There's also an impact on the way emerging market currencies are being caught up in this. There was a lot of flow into emerging market currencies. If you look at the Brazilian real, the Turkish lira, and obviously our own rand, were beneficiaries in the early part of this year of a softer dollar, but we're starting to see some of that reverse. I see some people were pointing to the weakness in the rand yesterday being the details of the budget finally being digested. I think it's far more what we're seeing happening in global bond markets at the moment. How do you see that impacting the rand?
I think the broad brushstroke is that the dollar is very much a counter-cyclical currency, and as economies start opening up from COVID and expanding, so that will put pressure on the likes of the dollar and be supportive of emerging market equities and so on. South Africa, of course, has got its own specific nuances, but if anything, our local news flow, I would have thought, looks quite positive. Apart from the noise that we've been seeing in precious metals, bearing in mind that precious metals are in some ways defensive of a risky environment, however they also are hedges against inflation, so there's a little bit of a tug of war going on there in that particular asset class. It's quite messy, and I think it's coming through in the rand a lot. I think frankly it's external drivers throwing the rand around at the moment. I think we are probably fairly finely balanced and fairly well discounted.
And that leads us then to the budget, Raymond. If you think that the rand barely moved in response to Tito Mboweni's budget, the markets broadly welcomed a budget that promises to rein in the debt and the amount that we're spending on servicing that debt. 20 cents out of every rand, 20% is going on servicing that debt, which just crowds out all other government spending. But overall, what did you like about the budget?
Hi, Michael. Look, I think the important point in any discussion now about the budget must be, as you've hinted, we've got to look at the budget speech, but that was only 20 pages. We've got to look at the review, which is 220 pages. So there are things in the budget which are not in the review. There are one or two things, but there are many things in the review which are not in the budget speech because it was a fairly short budget speech. So it's very important to look at the total picture. Now, against that background, let me say there are three positive things that I liked about it. The first was the fact that there was better economic and fiscal news in the budget. Secondly, I thought there was a lot of pragmatism in the budget, a recognition that there had to be trade-offs. Now, we can disagree as to the extent of the trade-offs, but I think underlying them was a sense of pragmatism that there needed to be certain trade-offs between the present and the future. And the third was a positive narrative. I think if we go back to the past year, if we go back to the budget a year ago, we go to the supplementary budget in June, we go to the so-called mini budget in October, they were all somber messages. And I think at least in this budget, we could, in a realistic way, look at some more better news on which to build. Now, that was important. If I could just unpack one or two of them quickly. The first is, if we looked at the better economic and fiscal news, firstly, in the world economy, being underpinned by the rapid rollout of the vaccination programs and the stimulus packages, all the forecasts for the global economy are positive, are even improving in the past few days. And it's good for our commodity prices. We've already seen that in the numbers. Second point under that heading would be the rebound we're expecting in our economy this year, which the minister puts at 3.3%. Well, you know, I've said before, what's a decimal point between friends? Let's say it's going to be about 3%. And then finally, there was a bonus in terms of the unexpected tax revenues, which helped to give him some space to maneuver. And I think we'll probably come to that, how he's best used it. And then the other point about the pragmatism, I think once again, that was important, that there were trade-offs in the budget designed to give us a good snapshot picture of where we should be going from here. Whether the moving picture looks as good as the snapshot picture, that we must come back to. But the third point is the narrative. I think it's very important psychologically for a country and for South Africa now, after a terrible year from both a health and an economic point of view, to be able to build on some better economic news. Yeah. So I think from the point of view of what I liked about it, I liked the tone, I liked some of the rhetoric, and we must discuss some of the realities.
And we will come back to that, Raymond. Warwick, I just want to pick up on that last point about narrative, because what we saw from Anglo CEO Mark Cutifani when the mining giant announced its results yesterday, and it's now being hailed as a 10-bagger again, having gone from 50 to well over 500 because of this capital discipline. But the comments that really struck me were Mark Cutifani's comments about relaxing exchange controls and allowing Anglo to tap into a lot of this capital that sits on its balance sheet to now potentially pursue acquisitions offshore in an easier way. And he seemed to indicate that this gives him a lot more confidence now about the current investment environment in the country. I don't think many people are talking about this, but surely that's a big positive for the narrative. What did you make of the budget?
I liked the consistency that came through. I think with the way in which he kept it so tight, I mean, Raymond was referring there to less than 20 pages on the budget speech itself. I mean, there wasn't a lot of changes in terms of underlying taxes, structures, and so on. It basically was just a steady rolling drum there. And I think that actually builds policy certainty for investors. In terms of Forex and the ability to import and export Forex, I mean, it's very much a two-way street. I mean, one of the ways to be sure to build confidence of investors to bring money into your country is to guarantee them the ability to take it the other way as well. And that, for example, was how a despot like Suharto of Indonesia more than 40 years ago built the confidence and such a high degree of investment in this country, despite being non-democratic and frankly a nasty dictator, was because he had a relatively relaxed approach towards Forex. And it's a lesson well worth bearing in mind.
You mentioned the positive narrative, but I actually question the narrative around economic growth. Yes, we're going to jump by 3 or 3.3% this year. It then tapers off to below 2%. Over the medium-term expenditure framework. Now, surely, if we're implementing all of these structural reforms, Treasury would say, we're going to grow at 3, 4, 5%. This seems to me to indicate that there's not much confidence in these much-vaunted structural reforms.
Well, Michael, I think the point we've got to make here, and this is the thin ice, of course, that you're making some assumptions where you are saying, we think we will grow at X percent. We will get the actual public sector wage bill under control, and we will get the tax revenues. Those are calculated risks, because the jaws of this hippo are not going to close until 2025, actually. And so it's what we do in between that's quite important. And I come back to the point that I am less worried about the rebound this year, whether it's 2 or 3 or whatever percent it may be. It's going to happen. I'm more concerned whether beyond the budget and beyond the control of the Minister of Finance and the National Treasury, we're putting in place the fundamentals, the certainties we need to boost the total capital formation, which needs to sustain the growth beyond this year. I'm more concerned with what happens beyond this year, because that's important. That's where you want your long-term investor to take a long-term view, to be committed to South Africa over the long haul. And in this regard, I'm not only talking about private investment, it also means that these great infrastructural plans, this shift from consumption to investment, boosting investment and trying to cut the public sector wage bill, is part of the strategy. But you must be able to implement it. You must be able to show this time round that your colleagues, not the Treasury, your colleagues will take the ball and run with it and make it happen. So I think that's tremendously important to me, what lies beyond this year, what lies beyond 2021. Are we putting the foundations in place in order to ensure that the growth beyond that year will take over from what the minister himself said is merely a rebound this year? And I think that is the big challenge that lies beyond this budget.
And the big risk to pick up on that, Warwick, is the public sector wage bill. And as much as the minister has been lauded for taking a no-nonsense approach and a hardline approach to this, there are many who fear that this is where the deepest pushback is going to be, because it's become such an acrimonious relationship. The court case, the constitutional court case, is looming, and we've gone into a yearly budget negotiation cycle. And if you chat to Labour, the constant refrain is that government's not doing enough to tackle other areas like corruption and fruitless and wasteful expenditure. And it's very difficult to grow a country with that kind of acrimonious relationship between the public sector employer and its employees.
It's certainly not helpful, Michael. I think, quite frankly, on the part of COSATU, it's a bit of a red herring that they're throwing around for distraction here, because when it comes to the governance and corruption, frankly, they've been as much of a part of the problem as anyone else. I think in terms of building on what Raymond had to say there, though, is that I would like to have seen the budget have a consequences narrative. I don't think there was enough discussion along the lines of what happens if certain things aren't achieved. So, for example, we've had these four or five key economic initiatives that have been stated as national policy, and the consequences of either achieving them or not achieving them, I felt, was something that should very importantly have been spelled out, because they are a key part of meeting those growth objectives and closing those hippo's jaws. So we could have had the discussion on what are the consequences in relation to the wage bill, the likes of getting the whole spectrum issue sorted, and so on and so forth. And that wasn't spelt out. And of course, getting Eskom sorted out. Yeah. All of these matter very, very much. I mean, right now, South Africa's economic progression is a very fragile and delicate balancing act.
In fact, that was the big issue, Raymond, by omission, was what was not said about Eskom in the speech, and even deep within the budget review, very little in terms of dealing with Eskom's 480 billion rand debt pile.
Well, all I was going to say was that we just want to underscore again what I think both Warwick and myself are saying, that if one or two of these assumptions are not realized, then we're in deeper trouble again. And the important point is to realize we have to realize these targets. These are the minimum targets you have to reach in order to avoid a worst case scenario on the debt side later. And we must understand, as I think even the DG of the Treasury has already said, take out the pillar of what we want to do on the public sector wage bill and we are in trouble. So I think we just understand these are very narrow assumptions, and therefore the implementation of what we're intending to do becomes absolutely crucial again, so that we can avoid a worst case scenario. Build on the better news now, and that's tremendously important.
Given what we've just said, and Warwick, to come back to you, how credible are these assumptions in the budget? Are these more wish lists than actually achievable, given the politics?
Look, I think in terms of what some economists are saying, and what I think as well, is that it's within, I would, as I like to say, rather be broadly right than have to be precisely wrong. So I wouldn't like to tie myself to a number. All I'm saying is, I think that these numbers are in the right direction. But given the fact that we are in a very vulnerable situation, we can't afford to get it wrong. In other words, the margin for error in this budget is actually very small. Mm. And that brings us back to what do you need to do, therefore, to ensure at a very minimum that you will meet what you've said in the budget? If you can do better, well, so much the better. But I think the important point that's got to come through, these are the minimum you can do, and you've got to throw your weight behind it as a government and in collaboration with the private sector to make it now happen, because you may not get another chance.
Warwick, are there any credibility gaps for you?
I think we've just got to keep a very tight eye on the performance management of this whole deal. I think watchers are. I think certainly we have a much more honest political and economic dialogue going on in the country, and I think that's very healthy. But we actually have to see that follow through into real belief and buy-in from the private sector and actual practice of what was promised by government officials.
What worries me, and Raymond, I want to come back to what we see outside of Treasury. I mean, Treasury can only do so much. It can't do all the heavy lifting. Clearly, government needs to tackle other areas and blockages of reform inside the economy. But you look at the laws that government is pushing. It wants to introduce employment equity targets, some calling them quotas. It's pushing ahead with EWC. It's pushing ahead with a tourism fund that is only going to fund black-owned businesses through a pandemic where all hospitality and tourism businesses have been impacted. Very often you've got to look at what government does versus what it says, and what it's doing right now is further undermining business confidence.
But isn't that really saying, as we've discussed before, and indeed others have said, that you don't yet get the impression, you may get it in the budget, that there is a degree of coherence, that there is a degree of predictability which comes out of the budget. But when you look beyond the budget, when you say, but what is happening down the passage? Is Eskom now putting up its tariffs by 15%? What will that do to disposable income? If you put up fuel prices and you then at the same time cut some of the taxes, what is the net effect, even within the terms of the budget? But once you go outside the budget, you've got to say there are other policies that are tremendously important to the consistency and the coordination of government policy, and the message that we're going to stay on message and all ministers will march to the same tune. We're not there yet. And I think the important point here is to get that inclusivity, that coherence in policy that generates the maximum certainty, which on which you can then say the weak levels of our capital formation in the private sector will now begin to rise in response, not just to the budget, but in the overall impact and message of a cohesive and coherent policy in the years ahead. We're not there yet. This budget is taking us one step in that direction, but it's clear there are major decisions lying outside the budget which are necessary if we really want to see the stronger growth, the job-rich growth that we're looking for. And I think that's tremendously important, that the budget, as important as it is only one part of the bigger picture of getting a better response from the private sector in terms of investment and job growth.
And Warwick, how long do you see the market remaining favourable? Because it certainly was a tailwind to this budget, as we mentioned, the once-off windfall from increase in mining company profits translating into increased tax revenues. It does look like for certain green minerals like PGMs, the party has still got some way to run. For how much longer do you think the market conditions are going to remain a tailwind?
Well, Michael, as long as I suppose the world is on an expansionary type of footing, which I think it is for the next little while. I mean, many countries are trying to stimulate their economies using Keynesian type approaches. And typically such approaches tend to then go into major projects, infrastructure and so on. So from that point of view, that's obviously resource positive, which could continue to flow South Africa's way. But I guess in the meantime, the rest of the economy does need to find its footing once again.
And just on that point, because we have to end it there, the big joker in the pack too, from a policy confidence and coherence perspective, is will the finance minister remain in his position for very much longer? Because there is rumour swirling about a potential cabinet shake-up and reshuffle, and whether or not he might be pushed or go of his own volition is causing a lot of speculation on that front as well. We're going to have to leave it there. Warwick Lucas, Chief Investment Officer at Galileo Asset Managers, and Raymond Parsons, professor in the School of Business and Governance at Northwest University, talking about bonds, bubbles, and this week's budget.